This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The brazen assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother made world headlines in February of 2017. It's a strange story that happened to be captured on camera. The closed caption cameras at the Kuala Lumpur airport in Malaysia. Kim Jong-nam was the man's name. He was the eldest son of the last North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-il. At one point, he was considered next in line to lead the reclusive totalitarian regime. But there he was, all alone, no disguise, no sunglasses. He was wearing jeans and a jacket. He goes to print his boarding pass, and two young women approach him from behind. Remember, you can see all of this in the footage. They approach him, and they smear what turns out to be one of the deadliest substances there is, VX nerve agent, all over his face. He manages to walk to security. He's taken to an infirmary. But in about an hour, he's dead. In the next few days, the two young women were arrested, and this is where the story starts to get complicated, because they're not North Korean agents. They're very young women, one named Siti Aisha from Indonesia, the other is Doan from Vietnam. They don't know each other. They say they didn't know who Kim Jong-nam was. When they were arrested, they told Malaysian authorities they had no idea anyone had died that day. They believed this was a video prank, part of a Japanese TV show. They said they thought they were spreading baby oil on the man and that he was in on the gag. Now, the question at the heart of Ryan White's latest documentary, now premiering at Sundance this year, is what happened? Was this an elaborate assassination plot concocted by a reportedly paranoid and conniving leader of North Korea? Or was it something else? And what role did these young women really play? Today in the program, we're talking with Ryan White about his film. It's called Assassins. We were also joined by the Malaysian journalist Hadi Azmi. Ryan White has made a number of documentaries over the years. His Netflix series, The Keepers, was wildly popular. It was about a dead nun and child sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And he told us he wasn't quite sure if he was ready to make another film about murder.
After The Keepers, because it was so wildly popular, we were getting pitched every true crime story. Yeah. And we had to tell our agents, like, no more true crime, no more true crime. We're not doing true crime. But fortunately or unfortunately, however you look at it, this story kind of presented itself in our lives. Mm. I think like 3 years ago, a journalist named Doug Block Clark wrote an article in GQ, this really amazing investigative deep dive into the life of Siti Aisha. The trial was just beginning, and so he did this really amazing investigation into her backstory and the recruitment of her, if you believe her, to be a part of this prank show.
Yeah.
And he reached out to us. So he had seen The Keepers. He had gone to my same college, but we didn't know each other. And he reached out to us saying, everybody is trying to option this article because it was the true crime frenzy. Would you just have a phone call with me to give me some advice on how to navigate these waters? And Jess is my producer. We had a phone call with him. And after that phone call, we thought, like, maybe we should explore this ourselves. So it was the last thing in the world I wanted to do was another true crime story. And I definitely didn't want to do a true crime story in a place that took 30 hours to get to,
yeah,
following a trial that's totally unpredictable. So yeah, at a moment's notice, you find out you have to jump on, you know, two long haul flights.
Yeah.
But I think the story was just too compelling to pass up.
So it's interesting. So you sound like, as a filmmaker, you were like, I don't want to be typecast as a true crime filmmaker, probably. Is that part of what you were thinking?
Yeah. And I still don't want to be typecast as a true crime. And I, you know, like, there is a murder at the center of this movie, but I always saw it way more on the global thriller side rather than a murder mystery. I think the murder mystery, which hopefully when people see the film, like, that's pretty easy to figure out the answer to. It's more the thriller aspect, the kind of noir feel,
yeah,
that I really loved getting to make. And also, if there's any through line through all of our films, and this is in The Keepers and Dr. Ruth as well, it's all our stories have been a focus on women. We still haven't made a documentary about a man. I don't know why. And so I think that was what was so compelling about this, was these two women who felt so scary and diabolical and, yep, cold-blooded to the world. And then when you start peeling back the layers and realizing they might just be like any 20-something woman worldwide who were seeking, you know, social media, stardom, a better life, a better paycheck. And what was it really possible that they were tricked into doing this? Then I couldn't let it go.
Yeah. That was one of the questions. Like, what do you think this is about? Because there is the crime part. There's the murder part. There's the international intrigue and the geopolitics. But in some ways, it's almost more about sort of the backstory of these two women and the circumstance that where they end up. I mean, that's almost the most powerful part of it in some way.
I would say we did something very similar with The Keepers, too. I know The Keepers drew people in through a murder mystery, and it was the follow-up to Making a Murder, and everyone expected something similar. And then 7 hours later, we had tricked people into watching a horrific story of child sex abuse. And I think this film is somewhat similar to that. Like, the spectacle of the murder, I know, is what will draw people in. And it is entertaining in itself. It is a spectacle.
For sure.
You know, this is all over camera, so the audience will get to watch how this murder went down, how the women were operating in the airport, how the North Korean spies were operating. But really, yeah, I hope when people leave the theater, it's more this feeling of the dangers, the cautionary tale of social media, but especially when it comes to the exploitation of young women.
Yeah. And we'll get to this here in a moment, but there's also another element here, which is, in some ways, it's also the story of Kim Jong-un, at least in this sense, that how he comes into his own,
mm-hmm.
how he is thought of suspiciously at first, whether or not this young figure can play the role that his father and his grandfather played as these, you know, iron-fisted dictators, and how he basically emerges is pretty good at it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, people are always asking us if we're afraid of North Korea's reaction to this film, and obviously it wasn't a safe film to make, and you know, there are dangers to trying to tell a true story about the North Korean regime. But I also like to say, I feel like our film is very respectful of Kim Jong-un's rise to power. So often he's caricatured, especially in the Trump era, of these two kind of seen as two madmen facing off, which, I mean, it's hard to argue that he's not a madman. But the fact that he got there strategically, and this wasn't just nepotistic luck that he's ended up with the power that he has. And so that sort of larger Kim Jong-un rise to power and where that all fit in the Kim dynasty, that became a through line in the film later. We started to realize how important that was. And obviously audiences are fascinated with Kim Jong-un. And it's almost like a soap opera, the Kim dynasty, like how this all went down with separate families and half-brothers who didn't know each other. And so I think we tried to carefully but almost respectfully chart his rise to power and say this wasn't just luck, and this assassination played a key role in the power that he holds now.
Let's bring Hadi Azmi into the conversation. He's a crucial player here, of course. Hadi, welcome. Thanks very much
for
joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you, you talk about in the documentary seeing this particular story, which you started covering from day one, as a dream story. Why did you see it that way? Just as an opportunity, you're a reporter. This is a fascinating story. But how were you thinking about it in those really early days?
Well, it was a bit weird to see a dream story because someone died in it. But I was looking at it in a way that it's not a regular murder story. It was not something that a clear-cut murder story. At first, when I heard about the case and I saw these two women murdering Kim Jong-nam, especially the point where I saw that CCTV footage of one of the girls, the one was wearing this t-shirt saying LOL, my thought was like, oh my God, this is so diabolical, so cold-blooded. They killed this guy at the biggest airport in Malaysia, and it was made into such a spectacle. They were making a mockery out of it.
Yeah.
So
there's even a moment in the film, sorry to interrupt you, but where you mention how one of the women, Doan, looks at the camera.
Yeah, she looked straight into the CCTV camera. Like, it was so obvious. So at first, everyone thought that this was like, it seems like a spy movie kind of thing happening in the real world. So I thought that, you know, like, this would be something really great to go through.
Ryan, let me ask you about the role of Hadi in the documentary. One of the things that he mentions, and you sort of point out in the film, is that he's a journalist, but in Malaysia, the freedom of the press is limited. Most of the media organizations are owned by the government. Talk a little bit about the part that that part, the complication of trying to tell a story like this when you have all of these. Things that we take for granted in this country about freedom of the press and being able to scrutinize those in power, it's a different dynamic there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I'm not in my own film, so like the first hurdle is always how do you tell this story if there's no guide or narrator to walk you through it. So from the very beginning, we were looking while we were there, because our film is about a trial, essentially. We were looking for a local journalist that could be our guide. And we were lucky enough to meet Hadi, and Hadi was covering it every day at the trial. So we started very early on in the process kind of working side by side collaboratively with Hadi, because he was doing his own investigations and reporting, as were we. So we were kind of sharing those things with one another quietly. But as you mentioned, the freedom of the press in Malaysia is quite limited. So we were lucky to find Hadi because he works for an international organization. So he could kind of bypass the rules. Plus, Hadi's brave. Like, we were filming in places we should not be filming in, you know? So I don't know how many times we got in trouble with the police in the airport. It was nice to have a local ally to talk the police down when they were getting angry with us.
Yeah. So Hadi, I kept wondering throughout the film, I have to say, and even now I wonder, I kept saying, can he do that? Can he say that? Is he going to be okay? Because, you know, you go against the grain of the Malaysian, their line of thinking through all of this, which we'll talk about as well as we go along. But Ryan just called you brave. Do you have to play that role? And were there times when you did feel a little nervous?
Well, I can tell you that the whole time we were walking through the airport, I was shaking, literally, because it was a restricted area that we were shooting in, and the police there obviously knew why we were there, because I was quite obviously pointing at where the incident happened and all that. But I felt like this is a story that should be heard like more broadly. More people should hear about this. So it was something that was worth doing, I suppose.
Yeah.
And it's also, I find it important because people finally get to hear from the defense side of things, because early on, it was just basically what people hear was basically what is coming out from the government.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just one side of the story. So this would tell you every single thing.
I want to, Ryan, let's just, if you could, I know it's complicated, but tell us what happened. I mean, at least the story is as most people learned it. Like, just take us through the moment. And maybe start with the extraordinary fact that the former heir apparent to the North Korean government regime is walking in an airport alone in Kuala Lumpur.
Mm-hmm. So Kim Jong-nam was the half-brother of Kim Jong-un. He was 10 years older than him. So many people presumed that he might be the rightful heir. Our film kind of traces the whole life of Kim Jong-nam. They lived separately, so they didn't know one another.
Yeah.
And Kim Jong-nam was living in exile, which is a story in the film that I won't get into. But so he was living outside of North Korea for over a decade before he was murdered. But he was always a huge threat to his younger brother, because he comes from the same bloodline, and he was the oldest brother. So there's rumors that for years Kim Jong-un was trying to assassinate Kim Jong-nam, to the point where Kim Jong-nam sent him a letter begging for his life. So this his days were numbered, most people think. And he was living a relatively private life. Like, he did kind of operate on his own. He was living in Macau. He was kind of a playboy in his own right, working in sort of the sketchy world of casinos and gambling. And, you know, he was no angel either.
No.
But he always posed that threat. And as long as he was alive, he did pose that threat. And we explore this in the film, but he had a relationship with China. And in a more like crazy turn of events of our film, we reveal that he had a relationship with the U.S. and the CIA. So,
it has all the ingredients, right?
It's unbelievable.
It's
yeah.
kind of unbelievable. Let's talk about Anna Fifield. She's the Beijing bureau chief from the Washington Post. She's featured in the film, and she kind of lays out some important background for the North Korean regime and the story here. Let's hear a moment from Anna. This is she's covered North Korea for a number of years, and as she talks about, she has this kind of obsession mm-hmm. with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
My obsession with North Korea goes back a long way. I started covering North Korea in 2004, and I have not stopped yet. So when the assassination happened, I came out of a yoga class. It was like 9 o'clock at night, and I looked at my phone and I saw it had blown up. Kim Jong-nam has been assassinated.
Kim Jong-nam, at one point, was the favorite son of Kim Jong-il, the former leader of North Korea.
He is being known as a potential rival for Kim Jong-un.
And it's raising suspicions that Kim Jong-un may have once again marked one of his own relatives for death.
It was so surprising to me, you know, the footage, to see Kim Jong-nam standing in this airport. I mean, it's so amazing to think, you know, I was trying to find Kim Jong-nam for several years before he was killed, and just to see him walking around, no hat, no sunglasses. It's really like, wow, I wish I hadn't been able to talk to him.
What do you make of that, by the way? How is it that he ends up in the airport without 20 people on a security detail with him, which is like, you couldn't believe that.
Well, this is a big question mark, why he was traveling solo. He often did have protection. He often, you know, was traveling either with his family or with bodyguards. And in this particular murder, he was operating completely anonymously. And so there's many kind of like crazy conspiracy theories on how he may have been set up or why that was. But yeah, like Anna says, this was a total mystery figure. I mean, she's probably the most dogged journalist about the Kim dynasty and Kim Jong-un, and she never got to meet him. So he was a total kind of like mystery man in that type of way who really valued his privacy as well.
Yeah. Hadi, what did you know about Kim Jong-nam, and where did he fit in the story as you understood it, at least at first?
Well, I've never heard of Kim Jong-nam before. Wow. Before this case. We all know about Kim Jong-un, his rise to power and all that. So then we find out that he is the half-brother of Kim Jong-un, and he fell from grace because he was arrested for trying to go to Disneyland at one point. So that was seen as something unacceptable for the incoming leader of North Korea to be, you know, seen at, it was humiliating for the regime. So what was surprising was that he, you know, for Malaysia has a good working relationship with North Korea for some reason.
You call it weird in the film. Like, yeah. It's weird that they have a good working relationship.
It was quite surprising because most of even Malaysians don't know that there's a North Korean embassy in Kuala Lumpur, and that for the longest time Malaysia can travel to North Korea without any visa. So it was in a way strange that they picked Malaysia to be where they are going to kill Kim Jong-nam. At first I was thinking that perhaps could it be that they had some sort of a deal, you know, like,
yeah,
I let you kill your brother at my airport and, you know, we keep our good relationship going. But yeah.
You've never confirmed that?
Was not confirmed. But I think...
But it is a question you have.
It is. It was
and it's a question raised in the film. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It was a question raised in the film.
Yeah. Ryan, let's back up and just talk a little bit about the North Korean myth, which you explore in the film, the mythology of the leadership of the Kim dynasty. Talk a little bit about this. That there's a bloodline mythology, and then there are these two competing players, as you sort of laid out before, these two different brothers who never really related to each other in a real way, But there's a mythology that I think people may be familiar. It's the way that the Kim dynasty sort of justifies its leadership as mm-hmm. being divinely appointed.
Mm-hmm. It's Mount Paektu. Yeah. I bet a lot of people recently saw this photo of Kim Jong-un on a white horse.
Right.
That's at Mount Paektu. Yeah. It's like the most ridiculous looking photo. It looks like something out of a fairy tale or something. But that's sort of the genesis, which Anna Fifield talks us through in the film, that Mount Paektu is kind of seen as like the divine beginning of this family. And so when Kim Il-sung passed that down to Kim Jong-il, and then Kim Jong-il passed away in 2011, I believe. And no one in North Korea really knew who Kim Jong-un or Kim Jong-nam were.
Yeah.
So they in Anna's book, she says, people still don't even know that Kim Jong-un has a brother, which he does, yeah. That the public doesn't know that. So the boys were kept very secretive, and they had two moms. We explore this sort of soap opera angle in the film that apparently Kim Jong-un's mom was very strategic, and that she was the one always kind of trying to get her son to be the anointed leader, and that she was successful in getting Kim Jong-nam kicked out of the family. So it's a fascinating...
Well, I wanted to actually tell that story because this is pretty interesting, and Hadi reference to it. So there are these two competing brothers. Mm-hmm. The second-born son has an ambitious mother, as you say. And then in 2001, something happens that kind of changes everything. Kim Jong-nam makes this really critical mistake. He wants to take his family to Disneyland in Japan.
Right. It seems so innocuous.
Right?
It seems sweet.
Yeah, it does.
He wanted to take his son was a toddler, and he, you know, he went in under a Dominican Republic passport that had a fake name, which the translation is Fat Bear. So it's this, it's an absurd story, you know, of him sweetly taking his family to Disneyland, but as we all know, Disneyland is probably the biggest flagpole of America.
Right.
And so for him to get caught, this was Tokyo Disneyland, by the way,
right.
For him to get caught by the Japanese police and it to become this huge international embarrassment, his kind of fate was sealed right there, that, you know, the future totalitarian leader of North Korea could not be frivolously taking his family to Disneyland and enjoying Mickey Mouse.
What does that say that this undid him completely? Like he was out because of this.
Well, and other people will say, by the way, that he wasn't fighting for the throne. So both Kim Jong-nam and Kim Jong-un, interestingly, were educated in Switzerland,
yeah.
Again, separately from one another.
Right.
But so Kim Jong-nam is often seen as very sort of like Western leaning in his policy thinking, in his sort of like progressive attitudes. So, you know, we have some scenes in the film of Kim Jong-nam, again, getting caught by the Japanese press saying specifically, I don't want to be the heir. And in fact, I don't think this should be a dynastic succession. So he was challenging that his brother should even inherit a throne and that maybe it should go to a more, I don't know, democratic process. So his way of thinking was also a huge threat to his brother.
That's Ryan White and the journalist Hadi Azmi. White is the director of the documentary Assassins, which is premiering at the Sundance Film Festival this year. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
What happens when a Mormon, a Muslim, and a rabbi walk into a bar? Join us at the Preach Podcast live show to find out. Special guests include comedian Stacey Harkey from JK Studios, co-founders of The Emerald Project, and a millennial rabbi. Plus live music and limited edition Preach swag. Preach Podcast Live is January 30th at the State Room in Salt Lake City. Tickets and info at preachpod.org/live.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about another documentary at Sundance this year. This one, an international murder thriller. It's the story of the brazen assassination of the half-brother of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, by two young women at the airport in Kuala Lumpur. It's a strange story. And at the heart of it is the question, are these women ruthless killers or just political pawns? We're talking with the filmmaker Ryan White and the Malaysian journalist Hadi Azmi. The film is called Assassins. Talk about what actually what actually happened at the moment. And this gets us to what I have to say was in a kind of it's an intriguing and kind of terrifying part of the story, which is the involvement of this nerve agent, VX.
So the women are all over camera. You see them approach Kim Jong-nam from the back. They wipe something on his eyes. Within an hour, he was dead. Turns out what they wiped on him was VX, which is the most lethal chemical weapon. One drop can kill someone. It's a hugely banned substance. Virtually, you know, only like the top governments have access to this. It's not something that a regular civilian would be able to cook up. And then the crazy twist of the film is that you find out soon thereafter that the women are saying, yes, we did that to him, but we thought we were on a reality prank show when we did that. And for months, we had been flown all over Southeast Asia, what we thought was a Japanese production company. Those men turned out to be North Korean spies. And we were doing the same type of prank. It's kind of like a peekaboo thing where they would run up behind someone and surprise them with their hands over their eyes. Well, they had been, if you believe them, they had been doing that for months with Johnson baby oil that was poured into their hands. And it was this harmless prank, and they were being videotaped doing it. And the final Johnson baby oil bottle was actually VX and murdered their prank actor.
Which they thought was the prank actor, which was
they thought he was part of the show.
Yeah. So this gets us to just how extensive this plan must have been. Must have been months and months and months in the making. They were looking for the right girls to do this. The fact that they had done these videos as kind of practice. These text exchanges saying, look, you need... There's one really chilling text exchange where one of the people who's working with, I think it's CT, no, it's Duan. And he says, look, we're a little disappointed in the way you're rubbing that baby oil in these people's eyes. You really need to get it in there. Because it'll just be a better video. She's and like, that's, oh, okay.
And those are the types of things where I think people fall on both sides. I think a lot of people would look at that and say, how is she not realizing that this is something nefarious? Like the text message is saying, hold tighter on the eyes, hold for 2 to 3 seconds, wipe down. But I think it's important, and Hadi is actually the one who walks us through that in the series, to look at this culture of prank videos in Asia. And as we explore, Dewan, who was the one communicating with in that text chain that you're referring to, she was already a prank actress doing the videos that to me, I don't understand them at all, are not funny to me, that I don't even understand why it's a prank, but there was this culture of doing these types of videos that would go bananas on social media or on YouTube, and she was already doing that, you know. And then we have we have Siti in the film from her police statement saying, which I love, saying like, I didn't think the pranks were funny, but they convinced me that people in Japan find them funny. Yeah. And then they're giving her $100. And Siti was a sex worker. You know, she had a very hard life. So to suddenly be able to make, versus having to work in her massage parlor and maybe make $5 a day, to suddenly be able to play a 30-second prank and then be given $100.
And get $96. Yeah, $100. That's a lot.
And being flown all over Asia, getting to go to all of these amazing places that she almost wanted to visit. So you have to really understand where the women are coming from, I think, to buy the sort of naivete that you have to take that leap to believe that they could have been tricked.
All right, Hadi, what is it about this prank culture? It's a thing there, I guess.
Yeah, I think funnily enough, while we were shooting at the airport itself, they have like notification boards, and they would play random prank videos at the airport itself.
Didn't you say they play like at the DMV while you wait on to get your license?
Yeah.
Governmental buildings.
Yeah,
everyone's watching these pranks.
Yeah,
constantly.
So while you're waiting for your number at the DMV, you'll be watching this all these prank videos being played. The advent of social media allowed people have always been watching this being done on TV, and then when they have YouTube, they have social media, you can shoot videos on your phone, people have access to do it themselves. They either, you know, emulate what they've seen, or they come up with their own ideas. So yeah, it's pretty common for it to be done.
Yeah, it's a cultural thing, and so no one would suspect. It's kind of, I guess, Ryan, if you think about it, a brilliant scheme, really. You can tell these two kind of naive girls who are desperate, one of which has ambitions of being an actress, Dewan. She's been in these videos before. It's kind of a brilliant scheme to fake them and tell them that this is an actor and do this horrible murder.
But it's the huge question is why? Yeah. Why? And, you know, I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that because no one knows what went through Kim Jong-un's mind in orchestrating this. But a lot of people, you know...
We don't know, do we?
We don't know why.
Yeah.
I mean, we can presume all of these things. And I think the natural presumption is Kim Jong-un wanted to create such an international spectacle, such a humiliating public assassination of his brother that it would have a chilling effect on any of his other enemies. Because what it said was, we can assassinate anyone at any time on camera. But then there's also the theories that, you know, Kim Jong-un grew up totally isolated and he was a huge fan of action films. He loved the Chicago Bulls. So he had this like real sensibility of loving pop culture. So some people presume like maybe this was fun for him. He did create his own reality show. But I don't think we'll ever really know the why. Was it done in such an absurd, brazen way? But the fact is that it worked.
Yeah.
It did have a chilling effect on any of his enemies, and he got away with it.
So there are these interesting elements in the trial that takes place. Now, let's talk a little bit about this. So you have a number of conspirators, co-conspirators in all of this. But in the end, really, the trial was just for these two young women. Mm-hmm. They become the principal scapegoats. Ryan, maybe talk a little bit about that. There were the North Korean players who escaped right after the actual assassination mm-hmm. itself. And then some of the other players. And this is an interesting element maybe you could talk about. This sort of gives you a sense of how the Malaysian authorities were thinking about this, that in the trial itself, when the Malaysian prosecutors had charged four of these North Korean suspects, they didn't even want to say their names aloud in court. Just talk about the weird dynamics
here. Or they didn't want to call him Kim Jong-nam in court because he was traveling under a fake passport.
Right.
And the official name throughout the trial until the very end, they were using this fake name. So it did feel like, and we have a press conference in the mm-hmm. film by one of the prosecutors where he's saying the political angle does not matter. The North Koreans did not touch him. They did not hold the VX. And it's incredible to watch them sort of ignore the obvious sort of engineering of this murder and only be going after the two women. But that's also going to be a question of why that we might never totally know the answer to. But the presumption on that is that this was such an international embarrassment for Malaysia, that this happened on their soil, that they had to hold somebody accountable. They couldn't let the entire team get away with this. And yeah, the North Koreans had all escaped and Malaysia had let a few of them go back. So it wasn't like they just slipped out of their fingers. And it was really baffling, I thought, during the trial, because this was life or death stakes. The women were going to be hanged for this crime. And it was clear that the prosecution and it was clear that the police, because they were the star witnesses, the investigators, were saying they were guilty and that these pranks that they were playing in the lead up were training and were not harmless pranks, and that these women were cold-blooded killers. And the only real evidence, because I've had to think about this a lot, the only evidence I've ever heard brought up in the courtroom that said these women knew what they were doing was that they washed their hands after they committed the murder, which to them was very guilty behavior, and said, we knew that the substance was toxic. And that Duan had done it in an aggressive manner. Because if you watch it on camera, it's not like a gentle peekaboo. She goes up like pretty hard behind him. But like you referenced earlier, she was getting text messages saying, you're being too gentle. Yeah. You need to do this harder.
Yeah.
It will
yeah.
lead to a better startling effect of the actor.
Yeah.
So the odds were really stacked against the women, and Malaysia really was out to convict them, which kind of becomes the whole through line of the film. Like, are these women really going to be executed for this crime that they're saying they didn't know they were committing?
Let's talk a little bit more about the backstory of the two young women, because as we were saying earlier, it's a really important part of all of the story. Suffice it to say, they came from similar backgrounds in the sense that they came from poverty, basically.
Yeah.
They were different in terms of their ambitions. You mentioned Siti, who had a really tragic story. She ends up very young, marrying what I guess is the owner of a sweatshop.
It's a sweatshop, yeah.
Loses a you know, loses track of her son, ends up, as you said, as a sex worker. She's in desperate conditions. Dawan, also kind of desperate, also has these kind of naive impressions about being a YouTube star or some kind of actress, some kind of performer. Both really primed to be manipulated and exploited. And I have to say, the backstory was an important part for me in experiencing it, is just realizing who they actually were. Maybe say a little bit more about that. And could you talk about how they didn't know each other when they walked into the airport that day, but their relationship becomes really important to them?
Yeah, so that's their backstories. You know, I would say who Siti and who Dawan are was always like our guiding star. Like whenever we were getting like too caught up in the true crime or the murder mystery or even the kind of soap opera parts of the Kim dynasty, we would remind ourselves like our movie is about these women. And these women could be any 20-something in any part of the world. And so our job is to get to know them as closely as possible, even though we're not allowed to meet them. So we had to do that through a whole other set of means that I don't normally use in my filmmaking. It's all the people that knew them. So, you know, we spent a lot of time with their families in both villages that they grew up in. One grew up in Vietnam, one grew up in Indonesia. Their lawyers were amazing. And, you know, the lawyers knew that they were going to be executed. So I think they were also desperate for the truth to come out. And they were sort of thankful that there was a film crew following it that would be telling it internationally. So they were willing to open up everything to us, which is a coup, because none of that came out in the trial. So you finally get to hear, like Hadi referenced earlier, the defense. But yeah, I think it's important to understand what led them to that moment. And you know, their backgrounds are somewhat similar, but also very different in some ways. Where like Dawan was educated, people hold that against her. She had a college degree.
You could have been an accountant.
Exactly. Dawan's very smart, and Sitsi's very smart too. But she left school in sixth grade, you know, and and ended up in a sweatshop. So people were also saying about Dawan, how could a woman who went to college, who had like great grades, have fallen for this? But as you mentioned, like she wasn't following that path anymore of being an accountant. She was following like a desperate path to be a famous actress.
Hadi, one of the things you mentioned in the film is that a life in Malaysia for migrant women, I think it can be really dangerous.
Yeah, it's not a new thing. It's been going on for decades. I've personally known Indonesian women who were brought to Malaysia being promised that they will work at a clinic. Once they arrive, they have to work as a domestic, as a maid. That is bad, but not as bad as those who arrive and being forced into prostitution. But that has been ongoing because Malaysia is it's smack in the middle of Southeast Asia, and we have quite a lenient immigration policy. So it became a convenient transit point for all sort of bad things. People from all over being brought to Malaysia, and then from Malaysia they are being shipped out to other parts of the world. So when I heard about Siti's background, how she was, you know, she came to Malaysia and then found out where she was working and all that. I was like, from early on I was quite sure that she was in the sex trade. I'm pretty sure that she could have been duped into doing that. But yeah, it was easy money, so it was pretty alluring for some people to do that.
Brian, you referenced this a little earlier. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the kind of intriguing idea that Kim Jong-nam was a CIA informant. That one of the reasons he had actually arrived in Malaysia was that he had met with an American agent, had been paid for passing along information. What do we know about that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of mystery around that as well, but quite a few reporters were doing some dogged reporting during this trial, and Anna's one of them, and it really comes out in her book when she published the book last year. It's called The Great Successor. That was a huge news story. I mean, when you can write a headline, Kim Jong-un's half-brother was working for the CIA, that's going to grab worldwide headlines. And so that wasn't the first time he was meeting with the CIA, and we trace it to this island island called Langkawi, which is, I guess, a few hours from Kuala Lumpur. Hadi and I actually went there together and filmed in the hotel where this meeting happened, and the hotel did not like that we were there when we started asking around. But there's a photo of him meeting with the CIA operative on an airplane that kind of went viral. I mean, in an elevator
yeah.
that kind of went viral. And then he was killed 2 days later. So he was passing back from that meeting through Kuala Lumpur just in transit when he was assassinated. He was about to fly home. So a lot of people kind of make the natural leap that this meeting had something to do with the timing of his assassination, that probably... We know Malaysia was aware of these meetings. Yeah. Probably North Korea was aware of these meetings. So Kim Jong-nam might have not been operating as surreptitiously as he thought he was. And that if, you know, finally he had pushed it too far, you know, Anna has this great line in the film where she says, North Korea is the blackest of all black holes for the CIA. So the CIA is desperate to get any intel on North Korea. And can you imagine turning the half-brother of the leader would be the biggest coup in intelligence to pull off. So if Kim Jong-nam, you know, all these other reasons we talked about earlier where he was always a threat, if he was directly threatening his brother with selling information to the U.S. or China, his days were clearly numbered.
Yeah,
his days were numbered.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the presumption of the timing of why he was murdered on that day.
So I want to let me play another moment from Anna Fifield of the Washington Post talking about how the death of Kim Jong-nam was fundamental to what she says was phase one of his. Of Kim Jong-un's plan for maintaining power. Here's another moment from the film.
And once he had taken out all his rivals, he had proven his strength domestically. He was ready for phase two.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Wanted to get the world's attention. I think now that he has proven he had a credible nuclear weapons program, he is now starting this process of trying to look like a respectable international statesman and seems very strong and very confident and very much in control of this regime.
This gets back at something you were saying earlier, Ryan, that our impressions of Kim Jong-un just being a kind of maniacal idiot, because I think a lot of people sort of think that way, is really turned on its head, at least if you think that he orchestrated something like this and that this was part of maybe of a larger plan. It was just something certainly that Anna thinks, and that now he's sort of placed himself, he's sort of there where he wanted to be, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we have this little montage at the end of him meeting with Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping and Moon Jae-in and Donald Trump, as we know. So, you know, he even got Donald Trump to say that he would, under his auspices, that he would have never used Kim Jong-nam as a CIA source, you know. And so many people saw that as Trump siding with Kim Jong-un, saying, like, don't worry, I'm not out to get your secrets. Your secrets are safe with me. So even, even Donald Trump was turned in some way. And I think Kim Jong-un, I mean, I think he is sort of seen as a statesman now, you know, and he was not. You know, when he was announced as a leader, like you referenced earlier, he was 25 years old. Everybody doubted that he was going to pull this off. I think there was one American diplomat who said, like, this regime will collapse within a week. And look where we are now, and look where they're headed. So, I don't think he is the maniacal buffoon that many of us thought he was.
Let's come back to the two young women. Hadi, you say in the film you don't think that those two young women, their lives will ever be the same.
Yeah, definitely. They went through 2 years of nightmare in a foreign country where they don't know anybody. And they've been, you know, played by this North Korean regime who basically threw their lives away. They don't care about what happens to them after the fact. And they are faced with a Malaysian government who is equally not interested in their well-being, who is seemingly willing to throw their lives away by dismissing all their all their whatever they are saying in defense of themselves. So people back home knew that this happened. So for example, Siti Aisha, her Facebook account was like, I went up to look up her Facebook account, and people who knew her were like leaving very harsh comments on her Facebook page. They were saying, this is what you get for being such and such, this is God's this is what God does to people like you and all that. So it definitely, they would definitely being affected in such a way. So if they ever go home, they would find people back home to be, you know, not really sympathetic to what they have been through.
Ryan, what can you say without giving away too much about how this has left these young women in their lives?
Well, I think a way to say it without like directly saying the ending is, I think I can say, like, I know both women now. I was able to meet them finally, and they were very different than what I perceive them as. Of course, like we talked about at the beginning, they were just perceived as cold-blooded assassins, and that kind of got dismantled at some point. But even what their personalities were is very different than how I had perceived them. And I think it's a really, really tragic story. I think they're both really lovely women, but I've seen Dawn's spirit be totally broken. So this woman that I had watched in so much footage on her prank shows, or she was on Vietnam Idol, or all these modeling photos, who was so excited about trying to be famous, having gone through this horrible ordeal where her life was at stake many times. I mean, she could have died from the VX, and then she could have been executed. That like hopeful glimmer in her eye is gone. And I think she's much more hardened to the world. Siti was very different than what I was expecting. You know, I knew she had lived such a hard life, and that's what I was tracing. So for some reason, I guess I assumed that would lead to her being very quiet and reserved and a smaller personality. She's a huge personality. She loves that she's the star of this film. She couldn't be here, unfortunately, because she can't travel. But she loved the idea that, you know, and it's what we always say is like, it actually worked out for the women. They did become famous, but for the absolute worst reason.
Right.
Yeah. Like, they achieved their goal, but it was not the way they wanted to do it, and it's not the it's not the type of fame that they want.
Let me ask you finally, back to what we were talking about before, how after the documentary series The Keepers, you had felt disoriented and felt just sad about all of these things. How are you left feeling after this one?
We were prepared for the world's saddest ending to this film. It looked like everybody that was on the ground said these women were going to be convicted. And this isn't ruining anything. In the middle of our film, the judge makes a ruling based on the prosecution, and he's saying emphatically these women are guilty. So we were all very morbidly prepared for their execution. I think everyone was. And then that made our filmmaking all the more important to us, where it's like, well, crap, if these women are innocent, which we're starting to think they might be, but they're going to be executed regardless, how can our film play a part in perhaps telling the truth? So we were prepared to release the film just after they were convicted, during a small appeals process before they were executed, and maybe just get the film out there and tell the truth.
Wow.
And thank God that didn't have to happen. I was just prepared for the world's saddest film. And what ended up happening is actually this very weird, warped, happy ending. I don't know if you can call it happy, because there is no justice for Kim Jong-nam. Nobody was held accountable for his death. But at least when justice seemed like it was headed in the worst of directions, something, which you'll see in the film, kind of reverses course at the last second. And so the Keepers, there were no answers. And people were just left in this abyss. And the Catholic Church learned nothing. The Baltimore Police Department didn't change anything. And this, at least, I feel like some little sense of justice for a couple of the characters in the film. So that at least leaves you feeling good.
Yeah. Ryan White, Hadi Azmi, thank you both very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Ryan White. He directed the film Assassins. We also had with us the Malaysian-based journalist Hadi Azmi. The film is one of the documentary premieres at the Sundance Film Festival this year. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe. Roddy Nickpour is mixing our shows at Sundance. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Ali Vallarta and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.